All right, from deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. All right, let's get started. Today we have Magic Andre, 1981, who left us a KB on the Hanging Shutdown issue on the last show notes. So there's a KB there. You can check it out. There's a hot fix, he says, for Windows 7 RTM, including SP1, which fixes a slowdown because of a hanging taskhost.exe. So if that's your issue, you could check out that KB. And once again, Magic Andre for the win.
One thing to realize, though, with hot fixes, you shouldn't just be applying hot fixes on your own.
Just because they're
just
there.
Just because they're there. It makes for some interesting scenarios on your machine.
Yeah.
Hot fixes are really designed for a hot issue. It's not designed for everybody, or else it would go out as a recommended update through Windows Update for everybody.
So read the KB. Make sure that you actually have that problem.
Right. Usually those KBs come with some sort of diagnosing to say, check to see if you have this problem.
Yeah.
But test it out first. You know, if you've got a whole bunch of machines at home, don't necessarily put it on all of them. Try it out on a machine. Make sure it actually fixes an issue that you have.
Yeah. All right, and then Taz.0 suggested an app for shutting down an internal disk for removal. It's called HotSwap. I've never used it. I can't endorse anything I haven't used. But, there's that. So
it looks like a scripted solution for what we talked about before, disk part, making the drive on offline.
Yeah, so if you're not a dev, you don't want to write your own, you could go try this and it might do what you want. Perfect. All right, so show mail. So there's a Windows 7 or registry setting to cause a file delete operation to become a file erase operation. So what they would like to do is take something that's been flagged as deleted, which means you've replaced one bit with a zero.
Yeah, I mean, you just hit delete.
It's
right?
Like hitting delete. And he's looking for...
Every time you hit delete, you don't actually delete the file. It's just marked as delete to the rest of the system.
And he's looking for a programmatic way to do a shift delete to... or in fill with zeros or something.
Well, I mean, remember, so a delete on a clean, regular Windows, if you're running delete or clicking on it and hitting delete or right-clicking on a file and saying delete, that takes it to the recycle bin.
That's actually deleted nothing.
That has deleted nothing. It's just moved the file as a temporary backup to make sure, hey, people do deletes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people, they want to recover that. It's sometimes mistaken. If you do a shift delete, that actually deletes the file off the disk, and that's it's marked as deleted. The file system, is going to overwrite that file. It's not saving any copies of it anywhere.
So is it actually deleted at that point, though?
It's marked as deleted.
Is it recoverable?
Oh, it's absolutely recoverable.
Okay. So that's not really permanently deleted. And the reason this person wrote is because they have some... customer requirements, let's just say, that says these are actually deleted. Mm-hmm. And so that's not actually a delete either.
No, the only way to really delete it is to overwrite that section of the disk that held the file with new information, and in fact continually overwrite it with new information. Like, depending on how badly somebody wanted to get the data recovered off the drive, if you wanted to take it to a clean room, crack open the drive, pull out the platters, run it through, an electron microscope, you could actually go to a lot of lengths, depending on how much money you had, to recover data.
Yeah.
For the regular user, when you hit delete, the file is gone.
Yeah.
One step beyond that is file recovery utilities, which will go back, find that file. We understand where the beginning and the end of that file is, and then unmark it as deleted to bring that file back, assuming that the data has not been overwritten.
Yeah.
Now, then, beyond all that, if you could continually overwrite that spot on the disk with new data, it'll be extremely difficult to ever recover it by any means.
Yeah.
But, that is usually well beyond the needs of any end user that's running a computer. Like, there are no systems out there today, by default, will ever do this.
Yeah.
Whether it's Microsoft or not, they just don't do this. It's very performance intensive. And there's not a lot of bang for the buck.
Yeah. And so this person should probably look at a third-party app that'll actually do this for them. And for the requirements here, his customer, he says, the government is requiring us to actually erase these files. They probably have some standards for what they consider to be erased that you should find out first and make sure that you target those. you might need to do like a 34-pass Gutmann wipe or something. So
Something insane.
Yeah, so...
you certainly wouldn't want to do that on every potential delete.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of writing, a lot of hard drive thrashing.
It's a lot of hard drive thrashing. Because remember, files are being deleted on your system, not only just because when you hit delete.
Yeah.
Right? There's temporary files being created and deleted all the time.
Yeah.
So you... To have a blanket statement where the OS would, you know, zero fill or random data fill every delete would be so performance intensive that your drive would be constantly thrashing and it would never go into a power save mode.
Yeah. So, Tony, third-party app, that's what you're going to have to look at there. All right, next one. I have 8 hard drives connected to my computer, 2 external USB, 6 internal SATA. 2 of them are in RAID 1. He didn't say. I assume the internal ones. I know one of them has failed since a RAID card says the RAID is broken, but the RAID card doesn't say what drive failed. Also, I go into the event viewer and found the events with disk errors to try and track down the drive port. However, I appear to have 2 drives failing. One instance says the drive 4 has bad sectors. The other instance says drive 6 has bad sectors. Is there a way in Windows to find out what port these bad drives are connected to?
So I'm going to address it in a couple of parts. He talks about, like, he's a relatively complex configuration where he's got an additional RAID controller card.
Mm-hmm.
Every RAID controller card I've ever dealt with has a management utility that comes with it that you can install that will tell you exactly which drive on which port has failed. So I'm going to leave that up to the viewer to say, you know, whatever controller that you're using, you should install whatever management utility is part of it. Additionally, a lot of those controller cards has its own BIOS. So as you're booting up the machine, you'll have your main computer BIOS and then like a Control H or Control Y or whatever to access the BIOS of that controller card.
Mm-hmm.
And that too will tell you exactly which port something is on, and it'll run diagnostics and say which one has failed. Now, the other part of that question is just in general, how can I tell which drive is which and where is it connected? Device Manager will tell you this. It's a little bit, by default, it's a little bit hard to find. You know, this is the default view of Device Manager, and you can go to disk drives. So, you know, here you found your drive, and here's your controller. But, okay, so my system is a OneDrive system. It's a laptop. Again, a little bit different, but for illustrative purposes, here's how you can actually see that these two are connected. You go to View and say Devices by Connection, and that will actually resort this entire tree into, you know, your controller, the port, and then the drive. You can take a look at how things are also connected on the USB side of things, assuming I had anything on USB. I don't actually have anything plugged in right now. But this is the, you know, quick and dirty way for on a system you can say which drive is connected to which port. And assuming that everything is labeled correctly on your motherboard, you can actually trace back from here and say, you know, which one has failed. If you wanted to take a look at the properties of the disk drive, under Details, there is a section here called Location Information. This will tell you, you know, your channel zero, your target, and your logical unit. This is also additional location information about your drive, how your system enumerates it.
Cool. Awesome. All right. There you have it. So the next one, this is a little bit easier. How do I pin my documents folder to the Windows taskbar in Windows 7? I have Explorer pinned to my taskbar, but when clicked, it opens the libraries directory and not the desired documents directory. So I used to pin into the quick launch area specific folders. And it works a little bit differently now. So let's talk about this. You can drag Explorer down to your taskbar.
Well, it's there by default.
There you have it. So,
and then you can do this. You know, you can right click and drag on documents and pin to Explorer. And then it's right there. So you would right click and say documents.
Or you can drag up. You can do list kind of thing.
On a trackpad, you know, the drag up it can be kind of tricky. So I still use my mouse buttons fairly fairly heavily.
And I like using a mouse, so I would drag up. But, you know, that's why there's options. Awesome. But that's how you do it. And it'll be an option up at the top of the list. Next question, Windows booting up slow. So we had a person who wrote a very long email about their Windows was booting up slowly. Mm-hmm. A lot of back and forth there, but for the purposes of this, let's just talk a little bit about this. You suggested, you know, the boot perf trace log as one of the ways to do that.
Yeah, we've talked about it in the past.
We have a show that I'll link to, too, where we talk about this subject.
The perf tools have specific tracing around boot performance.
Yeah. So there you have it. We'll link to both of those, and you can check that out. But, yeah, we'll cover that one quick.
You know, to talk about the problem a little bit more, it's kind of like, well, when did the problem start happening? Did you install something recently? It kind of boils down to the generic, you know, what do you consider to be slow, right? Like, what is reasonable on that particular machine? Each machine is going to be different.
Yeah, and if it just started all of a sudden, then that gives you a little bit better basis where, well, something must have happened here. But if it's something that creeps over time, then...
Right.
Yeah, right. Awesome. Next question. How can I make sure the time on my PC is perfectly accurate as possible? So, interesting question. We talked about this before. I thought my PC would keep very good time, but you had a different take on this.
Not all PCs are created equal.
Yeah.
The real-time clock in the PC can have various degrees of drift. So what... how many minutes or seconds you might lose. Some really, really bad clocks and really bad machines out there can lose as much as a minute a day. Some can lose, you know, a second a year, which is pretty reasonable. Some of these can be corrected by an updated BIOS. If you're overclocking the machine, that can have some adverse effects on your real-time clock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, timing on a machine is governed by a lot of different things. So you kind of have to look at your machine, how much time you're losing, how much time you think you're losing. Is the concept of as accurate as can possibly be, is that just a conceptual kind of thing? Or, you know, do you need it to do something very specifically? Like, I know for my machines, I've configured them to be a little bit more aggressive on time because I use them as media center machines, so I want them to record on time consistently.
So when you say aggressive on time, what are you saying? That well, first of all, let's talk about Windows 7. Mm-hmm. Windows 7 will use the internet to get accurate time.
Or time.windows.com, I believe. There's the Windows Time Services tools.
Yeah.
This particular TechNet article talks about it. W32TM lets you set which time server... all the different parameters, how frequently you would like to sync.
And how does it handle latency? Because you're only going to get as accurate time as you have measured latency, at least.
Well, it will only sync at predetermined times.
Yeah.
Right? So you can adjust drift, I believe, on here. I haven't looked too deeply into this particular one.
And do you know what the how often it updates by default?
By default, it's once a week.
Yeah. So I used the little app when I read this question. I went to worldtimeserver.com, and they had a little freeware app. Mm-hmm. And in that app, it let you change this, and it had it measured by seconds. It was like 655,000 seconds or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it let you, so if you don't want to do a registry hack or registry edit, you can use that to set it a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it measures what your latency is, and so I don't think that would be too big of a problem if you're a second or two off. But
well, I mean, if you're a second or two off every minute, then that's a big thing.
That's true.
It's how much you're off.
Yeah.
You know,
so if you're overclocking, you could set your time to update every day, every morning, or something like that, and then
if you're having time problems, if you just set your update interval to be shorter,
is
just going to be recorrected more frequently.
Yeah.
So that's all that's really going to happen.
At least every day you're going to start off with the right time.
Right. So, you know, and as long as you're not drifting too much at the end of that day, if you're not losing a minute or 10 minutes at the end of that day, then you're fine.
So what about setting it to like every hour? Is there a problem with that? That's not going to be a perf.
It's not a perf issue. Thing for your machine, but the time server that you're syncing to might not like it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have to handle hundreds of thousands of requests all the time. So if you're hammering them they might just cut your IP off.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you want to be considerate to whatever it is that you're syncing to. I've never seen needing it to be any more than once a day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's even that's being relatively
heavy. So what do you have on your media center?
I have it set for once a day.
Yeah. All right. Well, that sounds like a good alternative.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty reasonable. I mean, I don't think there's a time server out there that's going to kick you off for doing it that infrequently.
Yeah. Yeah. And set it at like 7 o'clock right before prime time, and all your shows are probably going to be right on.
Sure.
There you have it. All right. Next question. So this was a post I saw on Reddit that made me wonder, what would Gove do? So someone wrote on Reddit, I recently found out my gamer roommates have capped my download speed from the router settings, which I don't have access to. I found out through a missed text sent from one of them recently. I found that my internet is very slow and sometimes cuts off for periods of time. They play Modern Warfare 3 together on PC and don't want me to watch YouTube or use any general bandwidth. What stealth maneuver can I do to get out of this port cap that I'm stuck in without them knowing?
There's not a lot that you can do without them knowing. If somebody else has control of the pipe,
yeah,
and they are rationing it off, there's not a lot that you can do to get out of that without, you know, asking them. But
yeah,
if it were me and, you know, I wanted to at least test the water to see what I could get away with,
yeah,
it depends on how they're controlling those bandwidth caps. If they are targeting that particular computer's MAC address,
mm-hmm,
saying, you know, only give it X amount of bandwidth,
yeah,
you can change your MAC address.
Okay.
And that might get out from underneath that cap. However, if they're doing something like, you know, you got three machines, two machines, they say these two MAC addresses get 85% of the bandwidth,
yeah,
and everybody else gets 15%.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what MAC address you change it to unless you can spoof one of those two, and then you potentially have issues when both machines are running at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that, or you could buy your own pipe.
Yeah, that's true. You could get your own bandwidth. You also mentioned that you could reset the router, but that's probably going to just...
They're going to know then,
yeah,
right? Like, you can
tipped your hand.
You've tipped your hand. You can reset the router and then take control of it, password protect it yourself, but then you have, you know, the arms race of, here's a public router.
Yeah.
You know, the roommates all have access to it. You reset it, you gain control. They reset it, they gain control. I mean...
Yeah.
You're not really winning anything.
It's a cold war that nobody's going to win. Yeah. All right. So there's a couple options there for you. All right. Next question. So when I use a snipping tool, it will often freeze my computer for a minute or two before it completes a screenshot. This is when I click the copy icon. It will remain on my screen until I restart my computer. The issue has occurred on multiple machines that I've had. Is there a known bug here? Is there a fix? I've also seen this, too. Sometimes I'll do a snipping tool snip of my screen,
mm-hmm,
and after I select it, it'll hang for a second, and then it'll go to the snipping tool with the image share. Doesn't happen all the time, though. And so this is one you hadn't heard of this before, so it's not...
I've not reproduced this particular issue, but again, I keep my machines really relatively clean. I don't install a lot of stuff on it.
So when you were asking me about this, the first thing you asked is, what do you have on your machine?
Yeah,
and
like,
the answer
what else
is
might you
everything.
Have?
There's everything on my machine. Like, years worth of everything on here. So that's not... I'm sure if I started over fresh again, I would be okay, but...
The problem with lots of different software on your machine is you can install multiple different hooks. So, like, hooks can install in different ways. And it may not even be one particular hook. It could be a combination of things. You know,
it could be that I have Snagit and Camtasia, or I could have three or four other things.
And it might just be those combinations, right?
Yeah.
So without actually looking at the machine and trying to figure out what's common about it and comparing against a clean machine and actually just debugging the problem, you can't make a good determination as to what it is just by, you know, the question is, or the simple answer to the question is, it could be anything.
Yeah.
Does it reprone a clean machine, you know?
Yeah, that it doesn't.
And that it doesn't.
Because that's usually what I do when I have any number of problems, is I'll just, you know, wipe the machine.
Or, you know, what I do is I keep a VHD around,
mm-hmm,
for just that occasion. Is, here's a clean machine, and I want to be able to test something out. Boom, I just boot into the VHD and say, oh, no, I can't repro it. It's on a, you know... when I'm having to deal with something that's in the OS only. That's how I do comparison. I don't wipe out my machine. I need something I can compare against.
Yeah, and I should probably take better notice of things like this too. Like, am I running a second monitor? Is that one of the things that could be a problem? And it's just one of those things that, you know, I think about at the time, but it only takes a few seconds and it goes into the simping tool, so it's not something that really bothers me, and so I don't really remember these things. But yeah, if you take better notes of your problems, then easier to troubleshoot.
Yeah, what things can you actually eliminate, right? Yeah. Like, if you've noticed, I've never had this on my laptop, but I always have it on my desktop, and they're all running the same software.
Yeah.
Well, okay, what's different about your desktop, right?
Cool, okay. Next question, is there a way to get a thumbnail view for Photoshop PSDs in Windows 7 64-bit OS? Yeah, this is another one that it's funny. Sometimes you have a problem and you don't even realize that it's a nagging problem until you hear someone else say it. And come to think of it, yeah, seeing the Photoshop icon on images has been kind of a nagging problem for me. I always have to double-click them to find out what they are, or I use some other tool that I have to see those. But you actually have a way here.
Well, I found a third-party tool. I don't use PSDs or Photoshop. There is a thumbnail tool that a preview host, really, that you can install, and it appears to work even on 64-bit.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll try this out tonight, and I'll let you know next week if I have any problems with it. But this is definitely going to be a cool one for me.
Yeah, so. It's from Ardfry Imaging LLC, the PSD codec.
Nice. All right. Yeah, I'll check it out tonight.
This is a 15-day trial, so, you know, they want you to pay for it.
Actually have to pay. I think it might be worth it for me, though.
Yeah.
I have so many Photoshop files that
I
work with.
And if it's good code, then, you know, they...
In fact, I might wait just to see when Magic Andre says, here's a free version of this.
Again, I spent a good 7 seconds searching.
Yeah. You know. So first link?
This is actually the second link. The first link was kind of sketchy.
Yeah.
So this was the second link that I found. I'm willing to bet that there is a free one somewhere, but your mileage may vary.
Yeah.
This one might be better code. The free one might be better code. Try them both out.
Cool.
That's the great thing about software, right?
Yeah.
Try it. Don't like it. Remove it. Try something new.
Awesome. All right. I'll try it out. Next question. I want to know if changing the following registry entry will affect the behavior of my PC. It's HKLM system, current control set, enum, PCI, hardware ID. If I change this, would there be any side effects, like would Windows having problems? And you had a pretty simple answer.
Don't do this.
Don't. Don't
stop.
Do it.
Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of question is, that's my only response without trying to understand the reason behind it.
Yeah.
You know, why do they want to change this registry key?
Mm-hmm.
Under normal circumstances, nobody should ever change it. So they must be having some sort of problem. They want to, you know, seemingly remove a device. But, I mean, if that's not the right way to remove a device.
Yeah, and unless you have a problem that you're trying to troubleshoot or a goal that you're trying to attain, there's no reason to really be in the registry.
Right.
So, yeah. And
more
not
often
enough
than
information
not,
here.
You really want to stay away from HKLM system unless you know what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Yes, it will change the behavior of your PC. There's no telling how. And
it when.
It might be a year from now. So, and you end up with some problem that you are like, why is this happening? I bet if I flatten my machine, it'll fix it. And you have no idea why. And it's actually something you might have done in the past. So
That actually kind of comes back to when we're talking about the time issue. Is, yes, you can change it in the registry. But, again, you know, months down the line, years down the line, you don't remember exactly what change that you made.
Mm-hmm.
If you use the tool, the Win32 time tool, you can set up a schedule task, and that one is, you know, very present. It leaves a lot of evidence of it working.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an added advantage of not necessarily changing the registry directly, but using other tools to change it, because you can then reference the tools again.
Cool. All right, next question. Where can I store driver files so that Windows sees them when it searches automatically for them?
This is called driver staging. So a lot of enterprises, a lot of companies will do this. You know, they'll take their image, they will load it up with drivers that they know that their employees will use, but won't necessarily have access, administrative access to install them directly.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a wonderful TechNet article, staging a device driver to the driver store. It's a really simple utility. It's a PNP util that you point it to an INF, and you can just keep doing this for any drivers that you would like. You can pull down drivers directly from Windows Update if you wanted to. Keep them on your machine, so if you're in a disconnected state continually, you may not be able to go to Windows Update. You can stage the drivers directly on your machine. Things that you know in the future you're going to have. It's kind of a relatively edge case. You know, you don't have the software right there when you're installing a device. But if you're prepping an image, this is an easy way to do it.
And you might have, you know, a driver that you prefer over the Windows Update one. So, you know, you could always use that, too.
Exactly. Because the search order is going to be, you know, search the driver store before searching Windows Update.
Cool. Awesome. Next question. I went to update Windows 7 Home 64-bit version to Windows 7 Ultimate. I downloaded the 32-bit OS instead of 64-bit. The program let me do it. It let me do it. I loaded, but I lost functionality of the programs loaded previously. How did I roll back from 32-bit to 64-bit? Or they might mean the other way, but...
It was kind of an interesting question. Like, you can't actually upgrade from 64-bit to 32-bit.
Yeah.
So what I believe happened is they just installed a new instance on the same partition.
Yeah.
You can't easily go back from that.
Yeah.
They've essentially just, you know, installed over top.
Yeah.
It didn't keep their applications, but if it installed to the same partition, you can't easily go back. You can potentially do some trickery if it left a windows.old file there, directory there, to go back to your previous install. But generally speaking, if you've done that, you're kind of host.
Yeah, and so this is why we always say do a backup before you start. And if you had done that, you'd have been okay. We also mentioned, it seems like every show, that once you've done something kind of major like this, even if you could, you probably don't want to. So you're probably going to be better off, you know, should have done a backup, just, you know, flatten the machine again and go from your backup.
Yeah, even if you didn't necessarily do the backup, your data should still be there and accessible under the user's directory. It may show up, like, your username. If you go to the C user's directory, you'll see your username, and you might see your username .0000, and that'll be your old one.
Yeah.
So...
Okay, well, there you go.
You can recover data that way.
Nice. All right, next question. So I bought an ASUS touchscreen computer recently. The main issue is that the buttons and file lists and the folders are very small, so it's hard to click anything correctly with my fingers, especially with a standard XP theme. I was trying to decrease the screen resolution, but it makes everything look bad. I want to ask for advice. Maybe there's a Windows theme with larger icons. What kind of advice can we give them? I know you've got a tip, and I got one that I like, too.
I've got an in-box way of doing stuff.
Yeah.
We can cover that one first.
That'd probably be the best.
So, yeah, you know, this particular view of Explorer is not very touch-friendly.
It can be a challenge, especially if you're using a small machine like this.
Yep. One very simple thing to do is you can bump this, bump the views up to, like, extra-large icons.
Yeah.
Which now become much, much nicer to touch.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I just hit the Alt key to get the tools
the
menu.
Pull downs.
Under folder options, you can say single click item to open it. You know,
yeah.
So you just have to touch an item once instead of having to repeatedly touch it. That's one thing. And then the other one that I like is use checkboxes for selecting things.
Yeah.
So if you do that, you can now, you know, click once in the top corner to select it, but now all I have to do is tap once to open a folder.
Yeah. Nice. All right. So that's one way of doing it. I wrote a post on this a while back. I think it was right after PDC last year. So it's a Channel 9 post on, let's see, what is this called here? Get rid of my Outlook reminder. All right, so give me a side of scroll bar supersized. So the old UMPC origami pack, they had some functions to make the scroll bars a little bit wider and stuff like that. So on the old PDC Acer laptop that they gave away, I took mine and I used this. It still works in Windows 7. It makes some of the form elements a little bit larger, like the X up in the corner is larger. The scroll bar is a little bit larger. And so I use this on my machine every day, and it just makes things a little bit easier to use with touch. And so I like that, and it still works. Not not ghost method.
There's actually, to make those elements a little bit larger, the other thing that you can try, and again, this is part of the built-in part of things, is go to your screen resolution. Don't change the actual resolution.
Yeah.
There's this make text and other items larger or smaller.
Yeah.
The high DPI mode, you can switch to 125, and that will make everything a little bit more touch-friendly as well without affecting your resolution.
So setting the resolution down, it does make things larger, but you want to have straight through to the pixels on the screen. You don't want to waste any of those pixels, and setting your resolution lower is actually doing that. So you're using 800 by 600 instead of, 1280 by 720 or whatever you have on your laptop. So that is a good way to do that. It's, part of the accessibility settings in Windows. So also an option. But the Origami Pack works in Windows 7 too, so there's another option for you. All right, next question. How can I prevent Windows 7 from creating the contacts folder in a new user profile? And you just had one word on this. Why?
Why?
Why? So don't know of a way off top of our head.
No, I those kind of questions is kind of like it might be a nice to have kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So it creates it. There is actually no harm there. You could go after the fact and delete it.
Mm-hmm.
There could very well be a way to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know it off the top of my head. I don't know every possible setting that you can do in Windows without some research. But without a reason behind it, it's difficult to actually address if that's the actual problem at hand.
Yeah.
It could be something else entirely, and they're trying to use that method to address the problem, but they may not be doing it right.
Cool. All right, next question. Whenever I run a PowerShell as administrator, it starts in C, Windows System 32, Windows PowerShell V1.0. How do I make it start in my user's home directory instead? My $home has the expected value, user's account. Whenever I run PowerShell without administrative privileges, it starts in $home.
By default, you can't adjust the shortcut to do this.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do is just run a commandlet that will send you back to your home directory.
Yeah.
This is a security feature. Is when you're running it with admin privileges, it's essentially saying, well, I'm going to start in the admin location, so you can't plant data there that I'm going to now execute.
Yeah, so it's by design, and there's not a way to do that. Just run.
There are definitely other ways of doing it, which is running a script that will send you back to the home directory, or as part of your scripts, move to the home directory first. PowerShell is doing exactly what it should be doing.
Yeah. All right, next question. I am trying to find a plugin or another method to block Firefox with a master password so that a user can only use Firefox if the correct password is entered. Can you suggest a plugin, or if Windows 7 has this kind of blocking feature built in? Well, yeah, it's not built in to Windows, not something that would ask for a password when you start something up. And we had different views on this. Yours?
My view is have a separate user account.
Yeah.
I don't tend to see a lot of value in when I'm trying to run an application to put in another password just to run the app. If I should be running the app at all, then I shouldn't be prompted for a password. If I can't get onto the machine, then, great. I tend to look at it as, what's the access level of me on that machine?
Yeah.
Because it's like, what are you exactly trying to prevent? Are you trying to prevent running Firefox? Or are you trying to prevent the user from going onto the internet?
Yeah.
What stops them from renaming Firefox, right?
Yeah.
Like, how does a password protector thing potentially look like? How would it be protecting you? I don't know. I think about it more as, I'm going to protect my computer. I don't necessarily care about what programs that are going to be run. They're going to be run with whatever privileges that user can log in as.
Yeah. So when I saw the question, I was thinking about what would make someone want to do this. And the only thing I can come up with is probably they use Firefox most of the time. It probably saves their logins for a lot of their sites like Facebook and stuff. And maybe they got a little sister or something that they just don't want getting into Firefox. In IE, it's no problem because, you know, you're not saving your passwords there, and it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. So the app that I found was off the WindowsClub.com, how to password protect the use of any icon in or any application in Windows. And this will let you do just what we were talking about. And the example photo here is, you know, doing this to Internet Explorer. But as you mentioned, this might not be all the protection. If you have an advanced user, if you have administrative privileges, likely to be able to get around this. I mean, you could change the name, like you said, of...
I don't know how this particular one works.
Yeah.
So I cannot attest to how well it works.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know even where it stores its passwords, you know?
Yeah.
Are you really protecting anything in that case if you can access the password file, and then how does it store it? Is it encrypted? There's a lot of questions to be asked.
Yeah.
So I kind of always go back to, what are you really trying to protect?
Yeah, so if it's a little sister, this might be a good option. If you're trying to do something a little bit more robust, then probably a different user would be a better method to use.
That's what I use.
Cool. All right, so different options there. Next question, what are the differences between Windows 7 RC and the RTM? I'm currently running the Windows 7 RC build 7100. It works like a charm. With the news about RTM build and the upcoming release, I'm wondering what the differences are between the two builds. I've searched for comparisons or release notes. I've not found any.
Yeah, there's only one answer to this. Move to RTM.
Yeah.
Or actually SP1 in this case. God only knows how he's running this RC build. It should have expired.
Yeah. So you must move to RTM.
Yeah, I mean, the RC build does not get any servicing updates. We don't recognize it as a valid OS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we going to stop anyone from running it? No, except after a year it's going to expire.
Yeah.
You have to reinstall it anyways.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely do not recommend running the RC build of any OS as a long-term solution, because you will have unpatched security vulnerabilities. You'll have Windows Update not even recognize it as something that it can update properly.
Yeah. All right. There you have it. Will Windows 7 Recovery CD repair a Windows XP master boot record? Can I run fdisk / mbr or checkdisk on XP install from a Windows 7 Recovery CD? As far as I know, Vista changed the boot scheme.
If you did run it, if you did run Win 7 boot sector recovery, it was like bootsect, WAC, NT5.2, I believe, is what you could run on it. In order to give it the XP boot sector,
yeah,
it will work. You can technically even install the Vista boot sector on it along with the boot up files, because it's all backwards compatible. It'll still boot XP. But really, the ideal thing to do is use an XP recovery CD.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it'll just work there as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there you have it. All right. I just plugged in a Microsoft webcam to my PC, and I don't see any application to record a movie or take snapshots. In Windows XP, there used to be an option in my computer. Are there still any settings relating to this? What can they use to record directly to take a picture or shoot a video? So that's a pretty simple one, Windows Live Essentials Movie Maker.
Windows Live Movie Maker. We pulled it out of the OS in order to be able to iterate faster on it by having it in Windows Live as a downloadable.
Yeah.
Right now it's the best method for a Microsoft solution for a webcam app. If you're buying an OEM machine that has a webcam, more often than not it's going to have its own webcam app that's designed for it.
Yeah, but Movie Maker will let you do that. And since they said they had a Microsoft webcam, LifeCam software is pretty cool too. I used it this summer. I had a bird nest and I stuck a webcam up in the planner to watch the birds.
Did you do time lapse?
No, I didn't do time lapse. I shot a lot of videos and took a lot of pictures. And, you know, sooner or later I'm going to go through and do the cheesy music and, you know, going from eggs to these birds flying off. But, yeah, there's great software in the LifeCam software package that you can use for that, too.
Cool.
All right. Next question. I don't have a restore disk for my computer. However, at the bottom of the PC, there's a certificate of authenticity. Can't tell what the product name was. It's been rubbed off, but the number's still legible. I'd like to figure out what version of Windows 7 which was originally on the computer so I can install it and use the product key. Is there a way to figure this out by looking up the product key? No, there's not a way to do that. But what you can do is you can click on Start, go to My Computer, right-click, properties. And this will tell you what flavor that you got under the Windows Edition. So
I'm running Enterprise. Most home users are going to have Home Premium.
Mm-hmm.
If you've done an upgrade, then you went, you know, from Home Premium likely to Ultimate.
Yeah, or Pro or something. Pro. Whatever you have there, it'll tell you, so you can use that. Okay, next question. It's not really a question. It's an article I saw on How to Geek, and it says, do you really need to defrag your PC? And it was an interesting one. I wanted to get your take on it, and we weren't necessarily going to talk about it, but then we thought, well, let's talk about this. Because the article starts with, you know, if you want to speed up your PC, a lot of times people will tell you to defrag your PC. Is it really needed on modern computers? And they go over the, it's a good article I'm going to link to that goes over the what happens now compared to what they used to in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first to answer the question directly, no, an end user does not need to defragment their computer manually.
Yeah.
It will auto-defragment on a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
If you're running Win 7, then you're running an SSD, then it doesn't defragment.
And an interesting part of the articles that said how Windows 7 disables defrag for SSD,
mm-hmm.
but if you have Vista, you should remember to turn off this so it doesn't defrag anymore.
Yeah, and if you're running Vista, move to Windows 7. That's a better solution.
Yeah. So you could do that. But yeah, good article. And the other thing, too, if you want to get to the root of the problem, I want to make my PC faster.
Faster than what?
Faster than it is, probably, is what they're
But
they're
what
asking.
If it is as fast as it gets?
Yeah, and the best way, I mean, you want to start with the baseline,
right.
Flatten it right there. That's as fast as that PC is probably going to run unless you do some kind of hardware upgrade.
Well, right. I mean, you know, when you install the OS and you have no other things installed, it's at its optimum, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's brand new out of the box. Everything that's brand new out of the box is running at its optimum. You can do, you know, additional tweaks that may or may not work, but you can't actually understand is it making it faster or slower without knowing what the actual baseline is.
Yeah.
You have to establish a baseline. Now, you could say, you know, my established baseline is the OEM machine as they shipped it, which has a bunch of software that they've installed.
Mm-hmm.
That would not necessarily be my baseline,
yeah.
Right? Like, if I get an OEM system, I'm going to start removing things that I don't need on it. You can do things like disabling services, which we don't recommend, but, you know, there are definitely times where you might get a minor performance improvement by doing so. The less software that you have installed, the better performance you're going to get, but you kind of have to turn that mentality a little bit on its ear and say, well, you've bought a machine, you know, you've got quad core, you know, 8-way machine, whatever, you know, you have 8 gig of RAM, 16 gig of RAM. You kind of look at saying, well, do you want it to always be, you know, at 0% processor utilization, or do you want it to actually utilize the hardware that you've bought and, you know, optimize the machine for the workload that you're giving it?
Yeah.
Right? So if you're constantly, say, doing movie editing, you would not want to have a 5400 RPM laptop drive in it doing it, right? That's going to negatively impact your performance,
mm-hmm.
and your experience on the machine. You'll probably want to use, you know, a RAID 0 system with very fast 7200 RPM or even 10,000 RPM drives.
Yeah.
You know, that you kind of have to look at what you want to do with the machine and then tune what you're going to do with the machine,
yeah.
to have the optimal experience.
Yeah.
Whether something is, you know, 5 seconds faster on boot or not doesn't really matter, because why are you continually rebooting the machine?
Mm-hmm.
I don't reboot. I reboot the machine once a month when I get new patches. That's it.
Yes.
You know, so that you have to look at what it is that you're trying to optimize.
Yeah. All right. So interesting article. We'll link to it. And do you need defrag, though? Short answer, no. Don't worry about it. All right. Pick of the week. So this week's pick of the week, we're talking about the Nikos Zoom for Kinect. And I saw one of these at GameStop the other day.
I have one of these.
And I almost bought it, and then we were talking about it, and you have it. So
yep.
This is like glasses for a farsighted Kinect.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about how this has worked for you, and does it really work?
In my environment, it does actually work. Because I couldn't do the normal things that you would do with a Kinect to fix the problem that the Nyko's trying to fix.
Yeah, and the root of the problem is not everyone has as much space as they'd like to use a Kinect.
Right.
And the Kinect sometimes will take a little bit more than a small room.
Right.
So if you're already all the way up against the wall, then you could use this device to scale down that distance.
Yeah, what it does is make the field of view a little bit wider and a little bit shorter.
Mm-hmm.
For my situation, I have the Kinect sitting on top of a shelf at, probably about this level,
mm-hmm.
about top chest level. One of the things you can do at home with a Kinect, if you don't want to get this or if you want to, see what else you can do without purchasing extra hardware, is just keep raising the Kinect higher and higher, and that will actually shorten the amount of room that it needs. It shortens the depth.
Yeah. So it's creating more distance, basically, by
right.
getting it up higher as opposed to further back through the wall that you can't do that.
Exactly.
Cool.
And that may or may not work for you or for whomever has a Kinect,
yeah.
in which case, you try out the Zoom. I couldn't get mine any higher because I have a projector-style system at home where the screen goes right up to the ceiling, so can't mm-hmm. get any higher than that.
Yeah.
But in my particular environment, it's actually worked pretty well.
Nice. Yeah, I'm thinking about getting one of these because I want to use Kinect on my desk. And
that'll
so
be interesting.
I'll be kind of close, and so I'm going to try this out and see if it'll help me out with that.
That would definitely be interesting. You should try it out without the Zoom first, of
yeah.
course. Make sure,
yeah.
See if you even need it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Well, when you're using it at your desk, are you having the Kinect look at your feet? Because
no,
it should be able to see your hand movements
yeah,
without any
it's,
problems.
It's more of playing around with, Clint's crazy stuff than things that people are coming up with for Kinect for Windows.
Ah.
So, I want to try this out to see if I can kind of shorten the space and just see how it works. Plus, I don't want to stand all the way back at the couch in my living room, so mm-hmm. I'll probably use it for that, too. Cool. All right, so that's Pick of the Week. That's the show for this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can write defragshow at Microsoft.com, or you can comment in the show notes. We prefer an email so we can go back and forth with you, and I can set Gove loose on your problems. So write us, and we'll see you next week.